Les colloques du Collège de France.
The last bit of that talk was added very recently, so I'm only engaging with it partially. But first of all, I want to say thank you to those two amazing speakers, fantastic presentations, both on the same topic, essentially, of life course health inequity, but coming at that same topic from very, very different perspectives. And I think that we're seeing today, that's one of the really exciting things about this GenD project, is its real multidisciplinarity. It's specifically designed to bring these very really disparate disciplinary perspectives to this entrenched social problem of gender and intersectional health inequity. So I want to just start by applauding that, because I think it's a really fantastic thing coming from the outside, not being part of the GenD team. I also just want to make a very quick note before I go on about terms. Recently in our group, we've shifted to using the term health inequity rather than inequality, so I will be saying health inequity. And that's really just to acknowledge and place more emphasis on the injustice, the unfairness that the speakers have talked about in relation to the differences that we're observing, and recognizing that they are avoidable differences that we're talking about. So, where to begin? I guess coming back to my own disciplinary perspective, I am a social epidemiologist. I've been working in a life course framework for most of my career. My research has tended to focus on gender inequity in paid and unpaid labor and care work as social determinants of health, with a little bit of work around social participation and social relationships in relation to aging and inequity in later life. And I have to say that all of my research has been quantitative in nature, using large longitudinal survey data that follow the same people over time. So that's where I'm coming from. So those life course models that Michelle showed you, where we have childhood social position, working into adult social positions, all of which are influencing biological health through material, psychosocial, behavioral pathways, and then turning to elders' life course principles to help us interpret our findings, it really feels like home to me. These are the exact same models that we are using every day in our own work. Muriel's presentation on the importance of socialization in the processes that create health inequity, I think, is a really welcome challenge for social epidemiologists like me to engage more frequently with sociological theory to provide a deeper understanding of the social and the psychological processes that we're investigating. I think it is fair to say that social epidemiology hasn't engaged with socialization as a concept and the processes that Muriel's describing. There might only be one exception, but I would like to highlight it because I think it's interesting. 20 years ago now, Archana Singh Manu, who's based at ANSERM here in Paris, published with Michael Marmot, who's been mentioned a couple of times this morning, who's a well-known epidemiologist working in the space of health inequity based in our department, published a paper in Social Science and Medicine entitled "The Role of Socialization in Social Inequality in Health," where they did describe processes of socialization in relation to Bourdieu's concept of habitus, Bourdieu's concepts of structure, disposition, and practice in the process of embodiment. So really interesting that there was fairly early on in the discipline of social epidemiology this work that was engaging with the concept of socialization, albeit from a more epidemiological perspective. And I think really, I don't know what happened, but we lost that along the way in social epidemiology. I'll come back a bit to what I think might have happened, but there have been other sort of smatterings, I would say, of engagement with sociological theory. There are papers drawing on Bourdieu's concept of habitus in relation to differences in health behaviors, as Bourdieu himself did talk about. Those are often published by medical sociologists, though, rather than social epidemiologists. I think social epidemiologists have been more engaged with the concept of capitals and thinking about economic, social, and cultural capital, and those, the role of those concepts in health inequity. I recently had a student who attempted to operationalize these capitals and investigate their association with different health outcomes and different behavioral and potential mechanisms linking capitals and health in a big UK longitudinal data set that we have. So there's a little bit of social epidemiological work around that area, but really next to nothing on socialization itself. And why is that? It may partly be a lack of awareness and knowledge around the concept, but I think also we seem to be moving more and more towards thinking about intervening and finding solutions to what is seen as the problem of health inequity. And if we're thinking about solutions, socialization as a topic to tackle from an intervention point of view is probably quite complex, as has been discussed here, and I'll come back to that. But I'm currently co-leading a new research center in the UK, which is specifically tasked with finding solutions to what we call the problem of life course health inequity. So I want to kind of focus on that aspect of interventions, solution finding in relation to these really complex and difficult topics of socialization and embodiment. So I'd actually like to start at the end where Muriel finished her presentation, where I thought it was very interesting when she talked about that being without a normative logic and a political denunciation of the socialization processes that the Gendy team are studying, but also being willing to think about individual change in terms of, or working on individuals, I think it was put in relation to tastes and behaviors and habits. I'm going to lose my way now. So, sorry, I knew this was going to happen because it's complex. So I wanted to pick up on that because I think it really captures attention. And it's attention that we probably need to think carefully about if we're thinking about interventions and solutions in the sense that Should it be our intention to intervene in these sociological processes? Is this something that we should be doing? And if we think it is, then where do we begin? Because it is so complex. And I want then to come back to Michelle's metaphor of the fog, which I find really enjoyable. I got quite excited about it. I thought, actually, aren't we really talking about air? Because we can't even see this, you know, it's intangible, it's invisible. And how on earth do we even begin to intervene on something so pervasive and so kind of difficult to see and deal with? But then Muriel presented work from the team in Gendy where they are observing and documenting and describing socialization processes. We can't perhaps sort of tangibly investigate empirically all these aspects of the fog, but we can engage with socialization processes on that level. But something that came through to me in terms of those socialization processes and some of the work that's been done is that they're often done in quite private spaces. So, you know, we did see examples of socialization occurring in interactions with the medical community, in clinical settings. But a lot of the socialization processes that we might be interested in early life in particular, are often happening in very private settings. So on top of it being kind of pervasive and complex, it's also often very private. How do we intervene on that kind of family level socialization? Should we even be thinking about intervening? And this is where things like early years education, high quality childcare, family parenting support programs are sometimes thrown into the mix. These are often seen as ways of mitigating the impact on children and as they develop of growing up in social and economically disadvantaged circumstances. So, what do we think about that? Taking for example the example that Michelle gave us of that clear gradient in language acquisition for children, and by the age of 3, we see this really dramatic gradient. And this is very important once people start school, of course, in terms of accessing the curriculum and engaging with their peers, and in the ways that people are perceived in school. So we might think, oh yes, an early years education program might be the thing, might be something we can do to help intervene in that gradient. But are we essentially then sort of trying to replace those family socialization processes that Muriel was talking about with an alternative set of socialization? And doesn't that then bring us into those normative logics and political denunciations that Muriel talked about? So are we comfortable with that? Is that problematic? Or is it an acceptable solution to the problem of health inequity? And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. So we might also think that rather than trying to mitigate the impact of social inequity, that actually we should be tackling the problem at its core. We should be seeking to reduce or do away with social inequity. If the stresses and the unhealthy environments that people are experiencing are a result of injustices that are attached to a kind of complex web of particular social positions, should we be looking at tackling those injustices first and foremost? And if so, how do we begin, again, in this vast web of socialization and embodiment? And I think the kind of intersectional analysis that Michelle was showing can help point us in certain directions. So we see that those kind of age increases with the risk of hypertension that we all experience are experienced much more strongly and more rapidly for men from sub-Saharan African countries, for example, and other French overseas territories. So as Michelle was describing in relation to elders' principles, we might start to think then, okay, what are the mechanisms driving that? Are men in those communities more economically disadvantaged? Are they more likely than other men to be experiencing more racialized discrimination and abuse? Do they have different migration histories than other men in France? And that can help us start to understand the problem and start to think about interventions potentially. But then my question becomes, do we then target our interventions to those men? And this comes back to something that Cyril raised at the end of his discussion. You know, there is a lot, at least some evidence now to suggest that when you have those kinds of targeted interventions, they can increase stigmatization in those groups. They're often more expensive to roll out than universal programs because you're checking eligibility criteria and things, which adds cost. So is it better to target those groups, or is it better to provide more universal programs, despite the fact that our own work shows that need is not universally felt? And then we come to this concept concept of proportionate universalism. Cyril and I did not speak before we did these discussion preparations, and we both come to the same point at the end of our discussions, which might say something. It might just say that we're both social epidemiologists, I don't know. But this is a real push now in the UK, particularly at the local government level and at the devolved Scottish and Welsh government levels, to really think about policy in relation to this concept of proportionate universalism. So these are supports and systems that are universally available to everyone, but where there is extra additional focus and support for communities where we know the greatest needs exist. So I haven't properly engaged with the big ticket question about causation, except to say that I do completely agree with everything Michelle says about the fog and causality and the fact that, you know, it's so complex, then often these kind of very specific definitions of causality, how on earth can they apply in a way when we're thinking about these huge processes of socialization and embodiment. I'd be keen to hear a bit more about interventions and solutions in relation to these really complex concepts. But maybe we'll open it out to the floor for questions first. Do you want to come up?
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site. Collège-2-France.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.